Johnson versus Gonzalez. Ms. Barron?
Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel Kathleen Gasparian on behalf of the petitioner appellant, Samuel Johnson. We are here on the Board of Immigration Appeals denial of our motion to reopen. I have a number of challenges to that denial that I'd like to discuss with you, but first I would like to address the 28J letter that was filed by the department. I believe this morning or yesterday, I'm not sure if the court has had the opportunity to review it.
I don't know about my colleagues, but I haven't.
No.
Neither have I.
It raises two issues, which I'm assuming the
department... When was that filed?
My office received it late yesterday afternoon. It was faxed to me here at my hotel.
Well, normally with that, we would have it, but court was closed yesterday. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm ready to talk about it, and I think it's very relevant. The first issue that the department raises relates to our arguments regarding equitable tolling. The department raises an issue citing to Awad versus Ashcroft, a Seventh Circuit case, that if an alien fails to exhaust administrative remedies, that this court somehow loses jurisdiction over an issue. Awad versus Ashcroft is distinguishable from this matter, both on fact and on law. In Awad versus Ashcroft, the alien had a case before an immigration judge. The immigration judge made a legal ruling on a specific issue. That issue was taken to the board. The board ruled on the same legal issue. The alien then filed a motion to reconsider with the board and did not address that legal issue. So the Seventh Circuit found that there was, in essence, a forfeiture of the issue, such that it did not have jurisdiction to hear it anymore. Awad versus Ashcroft also specifically relies on 1995 statutory law. 8 U.S.C. 1105 little a, in parens small c, dealing with the authority of the appellate court to hear petitions for review. We're not under that. If we are, I'd be very happy if we're under the 1995 statutory scheme, because I wouldn't have to be here today. My client would clearly be entitled to a motion to reopen and remand to seek 212C relief. We're here under 8 U.S.C. 1252. It's a very different statutory scheme that I'm not going to go into because this court's already addressed it in Kerensky versus INS, finding that it does, in fact, have the jurisdiction to hear an issue that may not have been exhausted before the Board of Immigration Appeals. We also do not concede that we in any way failed to exhaust an issue before the Board of Immigration Appeals. Thus, because this court has jurisdiction, it can find that motions to reopen under 8 CFR 1003.44H regarding 212C applications can be subject to equitable tolling. And there's a number of cases in which this court has already held that motions to reopen before the board should be subject to equitable tolling. There's a very great analysis in Joshi versus Ashcroft regarding that matter. The second issue the department raises in their 28J letter is to claim that because the deadlines regarding applications to seek relief under the Convention Against Torture have been upheld, that the deadlines at issue before this court should also be upheld. I think it's very clearly distinguishable and highlights what is special about what we're here about today. 212C relief is different. Under the Convention Against Torture deadlines, an individual appeared before an immigration judge, and Convention Against Torture was not available. They went to the board, Convention Against Torture was not available. Convention of Torture became available after their order of deportation. So the Executive Office of Immigration Review set up deadlines that allowed people who were still in the United States to reopen those proceedings to apply for a new relief. That is not what 212C is. It's not the facts before this court. The fact of the matter is, in 1991, when my client pled guilty to his crime, 212C relief was available. In 1993, when he was sentenced, 212C relief was available. In 1995, when the order to show cause was issued, 212C relief was available. It was available in December of 95 when he first appeared before the immigration judge. It was available in February of 96 when he filed for his change of venue. But when he appeared before the court in July of 96, 1 week after the matter of Soriano decision, 212C relief was no longer available. He did appeal the board's decision, and he then sought what has been turned into a request for a prosecutorial discretion and a suspension of his deportation. He is now 11 months, has filed a motion to reopen. Basically, as soon as he found out 212C, found out about the St. Cyr decision, 11 months after the arbitrary deadline set forth by the Executive Office of Immigration Review.
Why is that arbitrary?
I would say it's arbitrary, Your Honor, because it serves, first of all, it is impermissible in that it is retroactive. And second of all, it serves real no purpose. The net result of the deadline set forth by the Executive Office of Immigration Review is to undo the St. Cyr decision. St. Cyr found that you cannot retroactively apply the ADEPA and take away 212C.
I thought it's more to not necessarily to take away, but to put some sort of a time limit on, and the board has to consider these things. So somebody who had a 1988 conviction couldn't come up in 2012 and claim 212 relief.
Well, actually, Your Honor, a person with a 1998 conviction who's now being placed in proceedings could seek 212C relief. The difference is the time limit is for an individual who would have already had an order of deportation. Time limit affects those individuals most harmed by the impermissible application of ADEPA. That, in other words, those individuals who were before the court who, like the individual in St. Cyr, had a settled expectation at the time of their plea that they would be able to seek 212C relief. In this case, at the beginning of proceedings, had the opportunity to seek 212C relief. Improper application of the law, and now this time limit does exactly that. There's no reason to set a deadline. Especially when it's weighted, the government interest in managing, at best guess, you know, maybe 10,000 cases is completely outweighed by the private interest at stake. We have in St. Cyr
the only people that get any type of benefit out of the St. Cyr case are people who plead guilty.
That is correct.
If you've gone to trial and been convicted, you
There is some litigation going on as to whether or not going to trial and being convicted still places you in the same position as St. Cyr. And I don't have those case sites off the top of my head, but I believe there's been some circuit splits on that issue.
I mean, aware of that, but I thought that it only applied to people who pled guilty under the theory that they pled guilty thinking they had a possibility for applying for discretionary relief.
That's the difference of St. Cyr, and that's the difference of 212C. That's part of what makes 212C different, is that as outlined by the Supreme Court in St. Cyr, you go through the quid pro quo arrangements of a plea agreement. You are giving up you are giving up certain constitutional rights. You clearly have an expectation in being able to seek 212C relief.
Now, the deadline of April 26, 2005 came almost 4 years after the Supreme Court. I assume that Mr. Johnson was unrepresented from his stay of deportation.
Your Honor, if he had been represented at the time of St. Cyr, we'd be here on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
So, until he was taken into custody.
That is correct, Your Honor. unless the court has any other questions.
And I take it that your statement about the 10,000 case, that would be...
That's that from some of the judicial notes in St. Cyr. The Supreme Court states that it looked at some statistics and found that between, in a five-year span, 10,000 people had been granted 212C relief. There would have been an equivalent about five-year span between the matter of Soriano and St. Cyr that would probably. So we're guessing. The only person who can give us a good number is the Executive Office of Immigration Review.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Dabla?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ana Zabla, and I represent Alberto Gonzalez, the U.S. Attorney General. This is my first time before this court. Your Honors, respectfully, this case is not about St. Cyr. Rather, this case is about finality. It deals with a statute that was repealed by Congress 11 years ago, a Supreme Court holding that is almost 6 years old, and a motion to reopen, that was 10 months late, which seeks to reopen a case, a deportation order that is almost 10 years old.
Do you think there's a point at which the agency's procedural deadlines could interfere with the substantive right?
No, Your Honor. St. Cyr did not say that the relief should be available forever. It concerned very different issues. It concerned impermissible retroactivity, due process, and notice problems. Here we have a procedural rule that was implemented by the Attorney General promulgated in order to implement the ruling in St. Cyr. We have over 2.5 years of notice between the time that the regulation was first published and the time that it was final, and then 180 days during which the aliens that were subject to the final deportation orders could move to reopen. And in addition, because the case regards the method of access to discretionary relief rather than the availability of the relief itself, which was the concern of St. Cyr, there's no protected liberty interest. And because of that, there's no due process claim. The deadline is required. This was, after all, abrogated by Congress 11 years ago. Did I answer your question, Your Honor? Now, as I said, St. Cyr concerned impermissible retroactivity, due process, and notice. The Supreme Court did say that they objected to the elimination of any possibility of relief under former 1182C, and they referred to considerations of fair notice and settled expectations. Now, these concerns are not applicable here, and therefore the case is not like St. Cyr. I would like to clarify one thing.
Why do you say they're not applicable here?
Well, these are three concerns. Impermissible retroactivity. Now, that is not applicable because this is a procedural rule. And as it's well established and as this court has said, procedural rules do not invoke the same kind of reliance, given that they, I think this court said in, was it Turkin, citing Landgraf, that they regulate secondary rather than primary conduct, and therefore the implementation of such rules does not raise the same kind of retroactivity concerns, even if it is implemented after the conduct that gives rise to a lawsuit or any kind of suit. With regards to the due process claim, as I said, there's no protectable interest. And it should be recalled that Mr. Johnson had two opportunities to reopen his case. It seems that he was eligible to reopen after the Soriano litigation. And the fact that he procedurally defaulted his potential relief by failing to file his motion in time should not in itself be a concern, given that one can procedurally default even constitutional claims. With respect to that, I would like to clarify one thing. Mr. Johnson was represented by counsel in his first time before the board. I think that was in 1997.
Well, sure, but, you know.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Well, I mean, he was told that it was over, basically.
Your Honor, the immigration judge, and I can take the record, did say at the time of the original ruling that a ruling could be handed down that would reinterpret the AEDPA or IRERA, that there was no indication as to when this should be effective. So the immigration judge did inform Mr. Johnson back in the original ruling, I believe that was in 1996, that something could come down from a federal court.
Well, that's kind of like saying something. I mean, he was told both by the IJ and the BIA that he was in. And, of course, all was denied. Why would he? I suppose he. When St. Cyr's decision. About St. Cyr, you know, I'm very curious about the selection of Great Britain in the. Do we know either from experience Great Britain accepts our convicted felon deportee?
Your Honor, Mr. Johnson requested Great Britain, and his home country of Nigeria was selected as an alternative country of departure in case Great Britain did not accept him. That was just by request. With respect to the to his not having had counsel, ordinary citizens are charged with knowing the law, and so are aliens. And as I said, the regulation was published in the Federal Register, which suffices as constructive notice. And the immigration bar, as was noted by both the board and in the implementation of the rule, is very active in letting people know about what's going on with the law, with the immigration law. This court has said that notice of the law is presumed for immigration purposes, and it has presumed knowledge of the law, and even when aliens have been outside of the United States. With respect to the Attorney General's authority to set time limits on motion to remand and the CAT, the Convention Against Torture, as was noted by opposing counsel, that was raised as an analogy. The rule in question is not 212C. That was repealed by Congress. The rule in question, rather, is 103.44C, which is a regulation that was enacted pursuant to St. Cyr. Now, when that was enacted, it was applicable only to aliens who pled guilty and who were subject to a final deportation order. In this case, this regulation is perfectly analogous to that of the Convention Against Torture. And that regulation, that time limit was upheld by every court. It was never a problem. With respect to the equitable tolling issue, the reason I brought up Awad is in the 212J letter was as an illustration of the fact that the bulk of this court's precedent supports the notion that the exhaustion requirement in the regulations is jurisdictional. There is an alternative holding in Kursunsky, but that seems to depend on, it seems to rely on Matthews and interpret the Matthews analyzed the requirements that were waivable and that were not waivable. However, in Matthews, there was a final decision for this court to review. With respect to this equitable tolling claim, there's no final decision for this court to review. This was never raised, and so if a close reading of Matthews, Kursunsky, and the case that it relies on, which is called, I believe, Abdel Kadar, which is cited in my 212J letter, all of these seem to refer to a different kind of, their analysis seems to be inapplicable here. Back to the abuse of discretion claim, it's completely unfounded. The board acted strictly according to the regulations. As to the board's denial of their request I'm sorry, Your Honor, my time is up.
No, it's not up yet until the red light is on.
It's not jurisdictional. So it's not jurisdictional. We can waive that.
The lights.
Oh, thank you. With respect to the board's denial of Mr. Johnson's request to exercise sua sponte reopening, now that was an exercise of completely unfettered discretion, and as such, again, this court lacks jurisdiction to review it. There's no standards to guide the court's review, and in the one ruling where this court has reviewed such a denial, it was not sua sponte. It was there was some reason given for the denial. To sum up, the case again involves a motion to reopen that was 10 months late, that seeks to reopen a deportation order that is almost 10 years old in order to apply for discretionary relief that was abrogated by Congress 11 years ago. And my time is now up. So the Attorney General submits the case and respectfully asks that Mr. Johnson's petition for review be denied. Thank you.
Ms. Zabla, do you come to us from the Department of Justice?
Yes, I do.
Okay. We have many agencies representing the INS. So. Nice to know that. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Aaron, I think your time had elapsed, but I'll give you a minute. To.
Just briefly, I think one of the points that I think I'm trying to emphasize, and I'm not sure if I'm doing it correctly, is these regulations are not procedural, okay? They are not merely just governing the procedures before EOIR. They step outside the statutory authority, and they seek to legislate. They seek to add additional requirements. In that regard, they cannot stand because they are not merely procedural. So I think a lot of the arguments the department puts forth rest on the idea that those regulations are truly 100% procedural and deserving of deference. I think my brief is probably a better argument regarding the lack of statutory authority. As to notice, the only thing I would say is the department relies on FOSS versus National Marine and Fisheries in their brief for the proposition that publication in the Federal Register is sufficient. I'm out of time, Your Honors, unless you have anything else.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move to